The subject of Mr. Jensen's talk is to begin rightly. Mrs. Eddy tells us that to begin rightly is to end rightly. And that's what I'd like to talk to you about this morning. Beginning rightly. In our prayers and in our treatments, from what premise do we begin? Spirit or matter? Mortal mind presents its material claims of disease and discord and lack to all mankind, it seems. And since most of the world is ignorantly deceived into accepting these material sense pictures as instant reality, they undertake to heal them in the only way they know, materially. But almost the first thing a student of Christian Science learns is that we do not, in the practice of Christian Science, use material means for healing. Gradually, we come to understand something of why we don't, and how we turn to spiritual means alone. This premise in the solution is pretty generally accepted among scientists. Most scientists believe in using metaphysics and using it alone, not to mix it. But there is one vitally important area where all too often we go astray. Any experienced Christian Science practitioner will tell you that 9 out of 10 patients come to them wanting metaphysical help. But to do what? To heal a material body, a material situation, through spiritual means. What does this effort reveal? Well, it tells us unmistakably that we too have been deceived by the primary error, the reality of matter. We have been duped into accepting the wrong premise, that matter is real, that man is mortal, and that therefore it is matter that needs healing. This, of course, is not beginning right. True, we are not using material means to solve our problem, but the problem itself is seen to be a material one. Our view of the problem is often as material as the doctors, or the referees in bankruptcy. The only difference in our methods is that we attempt to use spiritual means to cure it. Is this Christian Science? No, I'm afraid not. It would probably be classified as a form of mind over matter, or psychosomatic medicine, Christian Science style. Or at best, faith healing. But Mrs. Eddy admonishes us. It is mental quackery to make disease a reality, to hold it as something seen and felt, and then to attempt its cure through mind. Now, nothing could say it any clearer than that. And isn't that what we often find ourselves doing? In our discussion of beginning rightly, let's consider an actual case. I received a call one afternoon from a man who despairingly told me that the finest clinics in the state had agreed that his mother would be dead of a malignancy within 2 weeks. They said that it had spread over her entire body and there was nothing that could be done. So they were turning to Christian Science as a last hope. He then volunteered a detailed description of the medical diagnosis and evidence. As you can see, Mortal Mind, the playwright, was carefully setting the scene. I agreed to visit the patient. When I arrived, one element of sense testimony after another was convincingly presented and described by a group of medical nurses that were in attendance. No medicine or treatment was being given because they said there wasn't anything could be done. It appeared that every argument Mortal Mind could devise was set forth. A picture of incurability and hopelessness was depicted. Now, consider that you are the practitioner presented with such a picture. You are perhaps at the most crucial point in their case. You are perhaps at the most crucial point in the case. For it is here that the most basic decision must be made, and it must be made correctly in order to facilitate a healing. In spite of the vividness of the sense testimony and its claim to reality, there is a choice to be made. How will you view the problem? Which premise will you accept? The one that matter, the body, is real. That it has substance, life, and sensation, yet is destructible in nature. That it must be repaired or restored one way or another, physically or metaphysically. But it's the body that you find yourself looking at. And when it hurts, it makes it more real. But it's at that point that that decision must be made. Now, I remember when I was in college, I had a professor that every morning when we came in, he would say, mere repetition does not ensure learning. Mere repetition does not ensure learning. It's the only thing in the course I remember. So you may hear a little repetition today. Or, two, the premise that spirit is real and that man is totally spiritual, eternal, perfect, and indestructible. That therefore this so-called matter is but a mental picture. A mental picture that is unreal and illusory. Which premise can be accepted at the outset in your work? Now, sitting here in the calm of a hypothetical situation, the choice of a spiritual premise is pretty obvious, isn't it? But we all know we can often be partially or completely deceived by Mortal Mind's mental picture before we know it and find ourselves accepting the material premise. When I went into the Christian Science practice, my teacher illustrated unforgettably this point of choosing the correct premise. Early in her practice, her infant son had become paralyzed from the waist down with a belief of polio. Well, you can imagine how earnestly that mother worked, hours every day. And then, naturally enough, humanly, she'd look under the blanket to see if he could move his little legs when she finished the treatment. This went on for 4 solid months. And finally, she went to a practitioner herself. And she told the circumstances to the practitioner, who just smiled and just said one sentence, "Quit peeking, dear." And she saw immediately what she had been doing. And she said she hardly wait to get home and give that child a treatment like she should have to begin with. The next morning, she went to bathe the child, and he about jumped out of the pan. No atrophy, no time of recovery, perfect. And she said, "It never occurred to me to look at his legs again." I remember going, "What had that got to do with it?" "Nothing, nothing." I sometimes do this to myself when I'm working on something and the evidence appears pretty real. I just say to myself, "Nothing, nothing," to emphasize it. Because that's exactly what we're dealing with. A mental illusion. Even the most experienced scientists can be deceived, it seems. One of Mrs. Eddy's students told of an incident when our leader suddenly turned from the bedside of a critically ill patient she was treating. She walked to the window and in abject humility quietly exclaimed, "My dear Heavenly Father, please forgive me for looking at matter." The healing followed immediately. There was simply a change in promise, leaving the deception of matter for the spiritual reality. When mortal mind gradually or abruptly presents its vivid mental images to human consciousness, its picture of disease, discord, or lack, it always appears to be a material condition or situation, just as it does in our night dreams. We must be and remain alert to the fact that its picture is a mental deception, a lie, not reality, as Mrs. Eddy's experience shows. Now, may I dwell on this for a moment, because it's such an important point. Mrs. Eddy realized how deceptive sense testimony can be, particularly when it hurts. And she said that sleep and mesmerism explain the mythical nature of material sense. Now, what's a myth? It's a make-believe story. It's an illusion, isn't it? Now, why would she pick those two things to explain what we were experiencing? Because it appears very real. Well, sleep, it's the dream. And we all, everyone knows, everyone has experienced dreams and how real they seem. Or we wouldn't cry out or laugh or whatever, in a sleeping dream. But we know immediately upon waking that it was a total illusion. If you were driving a 10-ton locomotive and you woke up, what happened to that 10 tons of steel when you woke up? I'm trying to think of things that are solid and real, and it appears that way when we're in the midst of it. And by the way, you may find this very interesting in this regard of her use of sleep or the dream. You might find it interesting to go to the third story of We Knew Mary Baker Eddy on page 44. She wrote a letter there to Calvin Hill, who was suffering from a problem of a lung disease. Now, he hadn't told her, but she intuited this. And he was terrified because his father had passed on before him from tuberculosis. And she told him that this is no more real in your waking dream than it is in your sleeping dream. And she told him to go to page 188, paragraph 3 of Science and Health. And this talks about that waking sleeping dream, and it's excellent. Now, to supplement that, may I recommend that you go to line 15 on page 250 of Science and Health, where it begins, "And I ask, is there any more reality in the waking dream of mortal existence than in the sleeping dream? There cannot be." You see, she was trying to get across the idea by comparison with a dream, because it is a very apt comparison. And we've all been through that. And then to realize that what we're seeing now is a dream. Now today, scarcely anyone, particularly the young people, have never seen anyone hypnotized. But in her day, hypnotists were a part of every vaudeville or every act almost. Everybody in the street knew what hypnotism was, and most of them had seen it. And that's why she used the example of mesmerism. And I've often used some examples of that. I won't go through any today, but at first, I saw this clearer through the hypnotic suggestion because I've seen a lot of people hypnotized. But the dream is spoken about again and again in her writings because it illustrates the two are similar. They're almost identical. And once we realize this, it changes the whole nature of it if you can bring that to bear in your thinking. Now, I'll just tell you one little experience. My dad, when he was a young man, was rooming with another young man. They were going to business college. And they went to a show one night, and there was a hypnotist there. And his roommate volunteered to go up on the stage. And he hypnotized him, and he told him that he was sitting on a hot cook stove. And he was just sitting there on a little wooden bench. And pretty soon, he was squirming and squirming, and pretty soon he was just in agony to the delight of the audience, because they could see there wasn't anything going on. And he was screaming and yelling in pain. And finally, they let him off. And my dad said when they got home, he had big water blisters all over his bottom. So real had been the mental image. And we see that all the time in Christian Science practice. This hypnotic suggestion. So Mrs. Eddy used a very apt means of explaining to us the unreality of it. She said, and this is the primary error, the claim of reality in matter. Mrs. Eddy warns us, admit the existence of matter, and you admit that mortality, and therefore disease, has a foundation in fact. Matter is sometimes beautiful, always erroneous. A woman once came to Edward Kimball complaining that she had yellow canary feathers growing all over her arms. And he said, "Madam, there are no canary feathers in your arms." And she was just adamant about this. She said, of course there are. Look at this. Canary feathers were as real to her as anything else. Now, how much time do you think Kimball spent trying to fix feathers? And isn't that exactly what we do? His task, he knew, was simply to dissolve a mental illusion, a delusion. And he did this by acknowledging the spiritual fact that man is the image and likeness of God, and therefore perfect now. In such a case, it is comparatively easy to avoid trying to change matter and to start from a spiritual premise, because we know that women do not grow feathers. Birds grow feathers. But what if the woman had presented arms that were covered with an ugly appearing skin disease? Uh-oh. Wouldn't it be tempting to start from a material premise and try to heal matter? In reality, however, would the situation be one bit more material? Wouldn't it too be just a mental illusion? So wouldn't the same spiritual premise be correct in the starting point? Of course. But it requires consistent alertness. To be instantly aware that matter, good or bad appearing, is the illusion. And not be tempted to assume the premise of material reality and then try to heal it. Have you ever caught yourself in a movie giving a treatment for a picture presented there? I have many times. So I haven't had a single healing yet. Another very helpful assistance in learning to begin rightly is provided in that wonderful short paragraph on page 123 of our textbook. It reads, "The verity of mind shows conclusively how it is that matter seems to be, but is not. Divine science, rising above physical theories, excludes matter, resolves things into thoughts, and replaces the objects of material sense with spiritual ideas." It says almost the same thing on page 269. And again in miscellaneous writings. Now, just as an example, let's look a little more closely at the reminders that are contained in this statement. You see, we can't take these beautiful things that she says just on their face. We've got to think about them a little. Now, as an example of this, I would like to refer all of you to the March 1918 journal, the first testimony. You will find it probably the most remarkable testimony you've ever read in your life. But the thing, when you hear somebody hearing after 20 minutes of reading Science and Health for the first time in their lives, and they're hearing with an ear where the eardrum and ear bone had been surgically removed, think it might be worthwhile, besides the other things that she was healed of. But why I'm referring it to you is the manner in which she read. There's about two or three short paragraphs in there that describe how she read. And it's so important to see how she went about reading. And that's why I'm talking about this example of this little statement on 123, of taking them apart and thinking about them. 1918, March 1918 Journal. Now, in this statement, the verity of mind, truth, shows us conclusively, that is beyond question, decisively, absolutely, categorically, that matter only seems to be but is not. It's divine science which enables us to rise above physical theories, to exclude matter, and to resolve things into thoughts. That is to see that everything which appears to be material is only thought, a mental concept. Are you in this building, or is this building in you? Are you occupying a matter body, or is the body in you? When we stop and begin to think that everything we see, I sometimes hit my desk like this and say, that feels as real to me as it does to you. But is there a table here? Or are we seeing a mental image we have named table? If we begin to look about our bodies, can you identify your body without reference to matter? Experiment at it a little bit. A few years ago, my wife was teaching class to the little guys, and she asked them to describe their mothers. And every one of them described their mothers as kind and loving and so forth. So the next Sunday, I tried it on my college classes. Quite a different description. Now, which one was closer to right? Those little guys. And that's what we've got to see. When we see this, of course, the claim is recognized as a mental one, so can be dealt with. But so long as one is dealing with things, matter, he's not even in the ballgame, but he's still out in the parking lot. Why is this resolution of things into thoughts so important? Well, in the first place, when you're dealing with thoughts, you're dealing with something that can be changed, replaced, corrected. But who ever heard of an unchangeable thought? Do you see what this does to the claim of incurability? Who ever heard of an incurable thought? There's never been such a thing. This resolution of things into thoughts allows us to see things as simply illusions, mental mistakes or errors, rather than realities or frightful material conditions. Now, Mrs. Eddy required members of her household, for instance, if they had a claim, they had to put two words before it. Belief of. That a stomachache was a belief of a stomachache. Well, what does that do the minute you put belief of in front of it? You got a different ballgame. It's hard to think of it as matter if you do that simple thing. But the belief itself, you have to be careful that you don't make that a reality. Therefore, it keeps us from trying to heal, repair, or restore material. Are the rules any different? Do we start out to heal feathers? The delusion? Don't we have to begin rightly in order to end rightly with this error as with any other error? Our leader provides us with a clear sense of supply when she says, and I know you all know this, God gives you His spiritual ideas. These, in turn, and in turn, they give you daily supplies. Never ask for tomorrow. It is enough that divine love is an ever-present help, and if you wait, never doubting, you will have all you need every moment. Isn't that beautifully simple and direct? Spiritual ideas, she says, are what God provides. Now, starting with this realization that there is an absolutely unlimited supply of divine ideas, and that the activity of an idea can never be impaired or depleted, we begin to see that we are dealing with infinity itself. And sometimes it's helpful to just sit and contemplate infinity a little. It's exactly the opposite of the claim you're meeting of finiteness. And that's all there is to mortal mind, is finiteness. And as we begin to see this infinity, or eternality, take some time and think about eternality. It'll be time very well spent. It's not daydreaming. You're dealing with substance when you're talking about it. Because supply is as unlimited and ever-present as the Supreme Giver. Mortal mind tries through its delusion of finiteness to mesmerize man into accepting that he has somehow been separated from God's inexhaustible flow of ideas, his birthright. This sense, this beclouding belief, and that's what you're dealing with, folks. A separation, this sense of separation causes him to feel incapable of accepting or seeing these supply-producing ideas. It's like the miser that starves to death right outside the bank where he's got millions unknown to him. Ideas supported and enforced by divine law. So, it is the elimination of this befogging belief that we're concerned with, isn't it? We're not trying to create more supply, but are interested in having revealed what is already provided by our infinite source. And what alone can remove this murky cloud, leaving revealed this spiritual provision? Well, what allowed Hagar to see the well and to find the help for her child? It was God's angel, his spiritual idea, or the Christ. And that's what allows us to see the same. Now, I know this works. I'm going to transgress into personal experience that illustrates this point. It did to me beautifully. When I got out of the Navy, I went to law school, University of California, and after the second year, a friend of mine who was in the third year was about to take the bar exam. And he said, "Why don't you take the bar with me?" And I said, "Oh, ho, ho, ho. The third year is the hardest year of law school, with thousands of cases to be read and the heaviest course." And he said, "Come on, you can do that." Well, I went in and talked to the dean at this big law school. And he just laughed at me. He said, "Why, nobody's ever done that. You can't do that. You can't pass the bar with 2 years." Well, I left his office and went downtown and talked to my mother's teacher. And he said the most wonderful thing to me. He said, "When you're going to school, all you're doing is pulling aside the curtains of limitation to leave revealed what is already there. To leave revealed. Well, I learned the third year in 2 weeks. I took all the tests and got straight A's. I took the bar and passed it. It's the first time it's ever been done in the history of the University of California. Not because I was bright. There are a lot of fellows in the class who are brighter. But I got a glimpse of the source. Just a glimpse. But it was enough. And that's what we're doing, is getting a glimpse of the infinity of this supply. And that's why I wanted to mention that. God's laws are perfectly reciprocal laws of being that coordinate and are fitly joined together. What is apparent in human thought is one person or thing supplying the need of another person or thing is actually the reciprocal law of being reflecting the wholeness of itself. We should more and more recognize and utilize this reciprocal law of being that is ever in operation in our behalf and behalf of those with whom we deal. It is sometimes said that we do our work in the absolute, the spirit, and it manifests itself in the world of symbols, humanly. One thing we do know is that we don't start out to heal lack, or feathers, or disease, or any other illusion, delusion, metaphysically. We practice the science of the Christ by denying understandingly the falsity of the belief and affirming with confidence and constancy the Christ truth of man's continuing relationship to God. This truth dissolves the misleading lie of mortal mind that lies back in consciousness that we've fallen for. It's all that can or does destroy the false belief. Nothing else can or will. And leave revealed man's unbroken unity with God. We call this H-E-A-L-I-N-G. But its results are simply the side effects of this affirmation of what is real. In short, lack isn't truly overcome by getting more money, education, or possessions, but by relinquishing the belief of limitation. Supply isn't found by accumulating, but in eliminating the beclouding belief of lack. And that's all you're doing. And in that temporary help you may give or something, it sometimes helps to get a little lift. Sometimes when a patient has been working and working and working and they just seem to be exhausted about something, sometimes I tell them, you go on and go to sleep, I'll take it here for a while. And just the thought that this burden is going off of them for a little bit enables them to break the burden of that disease. Dis-ease, put a mental hyphen in it. Anything that puts us ill at ease. And sometimes that's what you're doing. You're breaking something of the spell and allowing them to get a glimpse. And that truth is quietly at work all the time, folks. That truth is at work, destroying the lie. Real supply isn't found in things coming to us. Rather, it's discovered in ideas which appear through us, through the transparency, the clarity, purity, and spirituality of enlightened thought. I trust that the spiritual nature of supply or God's provision for his idea of man has become a little more apparent. As it does, the means and methods of the work of your foundation will become proportionably clearer. These spiritually based activities of yours must bless everyone they touch. Don't lose sight of that. They must bless everyone they touch. That's the donor as well as the recipients. Mrs. Eddy tells us, matter, except divine metaphysics, disappears. Of course it does. She says it again and again. When she wrote the scientific statement of being the first time, she wrote it, there is no matter. All is infinite mind in its infinite manifestation. And then to make it more palatable, she went back and changed it to the way it is now. But if you take that first sentence the way it is now, there's still no matter. Then back in Miscellaneous 317, she says, spirit is all. And she says that in italics. When she says something in italics, you better look. Then she says, there is no matter. Is not only the axiom of true Christian science, but it is the only basis upon which this science can be demonstrated. Now, if anybody says anything cold turkey, that's it. There's no messing around about that. No way to misinterpret that. And it's the very basis of our work. Our books provide this wonderful healing light through their inspired statements of spiritual truth. For instance, isn't this a practical way of dealing with mortal error? Now, she gives us so many things like this, but I've just taken one here that I'm going to talk a little bit about. Now, think of this carefully. It's on 233, 28 to 29. She says, the counterfact relative to any dis-ease, put that mental hyphen in it, is required to cure it. Think of that required even in there. It must cure it. Or you can think of it required, well, it's necessary to have it to be cured. The counterfact. Now, there's only one place in the concordance that appears. It's two words. So when you look it up, don't look for it like I did for so long. It is one word. How often I've turned to this and begun the dissolution of the mortal plane by making a list of the counterfacts of the specific lie, then going to the concordances to learn more about each counterfact or truth. The wealth of specific truths just pours out and brings the light of divine metaphysics directly to bear. This is particularly effective when we feel overwhelmed or when mortal mind's opiate of apathy or discouragement suggests itself. Now, this process may be almost mechanical at the first, but soon the inspiration begins to flow. And sometimes when you're so overwhelmed about something, go to this method. I'll give you an example. One weekend, I had 6 heart attack cases. 3 of them passed out on the phone. There was a lot of commotion going on. Now, if you have a belief of a stomach ache or something, you think, well, in a little while it's going to be all right. But a heart attack? Ooh. What's the fear? Death. Now, what's the counterfact of death? Life. It's the only thing there was. So from my law days, I always keep a pad by my desk, and I grab my pad. I'd never done this before. And I began to write down the things that came to me when I thought of life. That was the counterfact of death. energy, vitality, movement, freedom, strength, so forth. These ideas came to me, and pretty soon I exhausted every word I could think of. So I went and got my thesaurus, and I took those words and I added them. Went and got a couple of dictionaries. I used everything I could find to add to it. In the meanwhile, mortal mind is giving me a hard time. It says, you better get busy, you're going to have some dead patients. By this time, I realized that this, the power within this. You see, the search is sweet. What's your state of mind while you're looking for these counterfacts of that lie? Spiritually, it's uplifting, it's buoying, as you're thinking of these things. I wrote down, I remember I got 65 of them before I quit. Remember, one of them was evergreen. Now, that maybe didn't mean anything to anybody else, but to me, it had a sort of freshness and vitality and renewal. Anyway, I went to my concordance and I looked up every word. Now, not everything fit, but boy, the ideas that come flowing out of that book as I read about life. I must have been 3 or 4 hours at that. By the time I finished, I had a clearer sense of life than I had ever had before. The counterfacts became realities. There couldn't be anything but life. When I finished, I felt that. Well, Monday morning, all 6 of them were back at work. Now, if I'd been trying to fix cholesterol or arteries or valves or something else, I could have been working yet. You see, it's this counterfact of it. And it's so simple to do. And no matter how disturbed you are, you can get a pad and you can begin to write these counterfacts. And pretty soon you feel the fear quiet down, and pretty soon it's making sense to you. And you read these beautiful statements that pour from our books. Beautiful things. You never saw them like that before. The loveliness of them will just come out of them. We're so blessed to have these books. You know, sometimes when I go into them, you know, she told us to look for in her books. And sometimes I say when I'm by myself, I'm coming in for a visit with my dearest friend. And I feel that way. And that state of mind opens it up, folks. I'm a little emotional about it, but it's exactly the state of mind you need in order to realize these spiritual facts. And as we do, the ideas just pour out of those books. You find you've got a whole new document when you do. And you are going in for a visit with your dearest friend. Or we work with the biblical truths, such as, cease ye from man whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of? What does this say to mortal mind's demand that we heal matter? Cease ye! We all know of these and hundreds of other familiar spiritual tools and have used them often in our healing work. But it behooves us to be alert at the outset, at the first onslaught of mortal mind's picture, so that we begin rightly from the spiritual premise and do not think we are using these spiritual truths to try and heal matter. This is the constant challenge, isn't it? I know people that have just spent years and years in the most earnest study. In fact, every delayed healing I have ever seen has been principally because they got down the wrong path. Somehow or other, they're trying to fix matter. And if we go back to this, remember the power you're dealing with is omnipotence. We have a right to expect this healing to come. Because the power behind us is so much greater than anything before us. We have a right to feel this way. Before we close, let me tell you the outcome of the real-life example we mentioned earlier. When the patient reported that every vestige of the disease had vanished, the cancer was gone, for a moment I tried to think back a week to when I first saw her. I then realized that the important thing about this healing was that for the life of me, I could not remember seeing a single physical symptom or appearance of that problem. So completely free from matter had become my view of her. Not for one moment had there been an effort to heal or repair a material body. Every denial and affirmation was single-mindedly devoted to dissolving a lie and seeing in its place the perfect idea of God. I wish I could do that more consistently. But it's a wonderful experience when you see this. Her son had been a close friend of the governor of California, and he had made personal arrangements for her to be examined by the finest clinics in the state. And their diagnosis was unanimous. There was no way she could live, that the belief had metastasized all over her body. But it had no law to support it. That belief had no source. It had no substance in its lying claim. And there was no law to support it, known or unknown, medically or otherwise. With that, you wipe the blackboard. Then you affirm what is true. And to do that consistently. Our leader sets this forth in a statement you know so well. Jesus beheld in science the perfect man who appeared to him where sinning mortal man appears to mortals. In this perfect man, the Savior saw God's own likeness. And this correct view of man healed the sick. Once again, healing is simply the practical application of the rules of this science of the Christ. It's part of the rules of this science of the Christ. It is pretty well summed up in this. We're not trying to see mortal man as the image and likeness of God. We are trying to see the image and likeness of God instead of mortal man. Doesn't that make our goal in healing clear? Now that's beginning right. Thank you.